If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ruined. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Allison.
And this is a podcast. We ruin a horror movie just for you. Allison,
just for you guys.
How you doing? Has anything horrifying been happening to you this week?
Yes and no. And I can't remember if I've talked about this on the podcast or not, but I recently upgraded from a regular, kind of handheld vacuum to a Dyson.
Which seems luxurious. So
Did we talk about my Dyson yet?
No.
I got it on sale. It was on sale. I was with Riz in the picture now. There's just a lot more vacuuming. But I did a once over of my apartment with it when I got it. And I guess I've never vacuumed properly. My other one was just for show because my floors look different in a way that I'm well, that's not just oh, Riz is here and there's some fur around. There had been other stuff going on that I was just not getting with my other shitty vacuum. And now I'm horrified at, I guess, the filth I'd been living in.
Yeah, I feel that way about basically every surface in my home.
I was
trying to clean my kitchen floor. It's hard to determine, is this just the way it looks?
Yeah.
Or am I lacking in some fundamental domestic skill? That's where I always take it. I'm such a failure. And then
I know.
TikTok.
I feel floors are I know how to, I won't always put in the effort, but I know how to get other surfaces clean. I know how to do my sink, my bathtub. I know how to do it. Do I always do it? No. But I know what the products and the scrubbing. Floors, I'm is this right? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess no one will ever tell you. That's no one would come over and be you fucked up and here's how you do this differently.
Yeah. It's true.
I would tell you you fucked up. I wouldn't be able to provide the other part
Correct.
Of the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's tricky. And I feel being inundated with TikTok videos, it's almost, ugh. I feel I know less about how to clean. I feel I've seen things, yes. I'm this seems it would eat a hole in your wall. You know what I mean?
Right,
this
yeah. Where do you get that product? An industrial supply store? I don't feel I can just walk into Target and get most of the stuff I see on Clean Talk, even though it's what I absolutely want.
Yeah, I feel the stuff they're using, we would just reach in the bucket and we'd pull out skeleton hands. It would just be eaten all the way to the bone. But then I guess your floors would be incredibly clean.
Yeah. And this goes back to I am going to get a deep cleaning service to come in and do a deep clean where they wash your walls and your baseboards and scrub your floor. And I'm just somebody else has to do that once and then I'm going to ask them how to not have to do this again.
Yeah, they love doing that. I think that's teach me how to do this so I never call you again. They're going to love that, Allison.
They're going to love that. They hate making money.
Yeah.
what's horrifying over in your corner of Los Angeles?
Well, Allison, I went to a burlesque show yesterday, and I have Well, I've never attended them. I think of, when I think of burlesque shows, I think, of course, the seminal Cher and Christina Aguilera film, which I saw alone. Theater was that? One of the East Village theaters. I saw it alone. I was drinking.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I sat in the back. I cried during Cher's number. And
I was surprised that the plot of that movie hinged on air rights laws.
Oh, yeah. When they pop that air rights shit. Yeah. That movie sucks so bad. I do want to watch it again. And it features this scene where it's torrentially raining in L.A., which I always thought was so silly. And then this year, it torrentially rained in L.A. for weeks at a time. So I was wow, okay, they were ahead of the game, maybe.
Yeah.
But, I've entered a new phase, in case you're new to the pod, after we've joined Crooked. I came out last June. So I've entered a new phase of being queer, which is I'm in a constant state of rage, is my lesbian birthright. Specifically at the hetero patriarchy. And I'm not mad at straight people and I'm not mad at men. I'm mad at the system. So I just want to make that very clear. And I mean that genuinely. We're all caught up in this and we all have to work on it. But I'll tell you, Allison, I was on a date at a specifically queer bar, mostly for the sapphic community. Obviously, anyone can attend.
Totally.
The burlesque show, other than the main performer and her partner or their partner, it was so straight. And I was like, what are all these straight people doing in here?
That's so strange.
I agree. I was like, oh, a burlesque show at a lesbian bar, basically. This is going to be wall-to-wall queers.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe my eyes, Allison.
Would you say that, like, the performances also kind of drew from a more straight gaze or something like that? Like, did you feel like the entire experience was overwhelmingly, or was it like, these are straight women and their straight friends are here?
I would say the performances were a good mix. So okay. I feel like some of it felt like, okay, we're just not like just stripping, but like just sort of like, okay, we're lip syncing, but it's certainly not for our lives. You know, we're lip syncing for today, you know, it's for the next hour. Yeah. And then other performances felt like they were, people had a bit, people had a look, like people were, I guess maybe it's like burlesque should be sexual drag, right? It should be as funny, as like thought out.
Totally.
In my mind, because I've seen drag. So it's like, if you're telling me this is drag, but I'm going to see some naked ladies, I'm on board. Let's do this. And I mean, to be fair, like, I mean, Sasha Colby won Drag Race as a naked lady. So I want to be clear. There's plenty of naked ladies who do traditional drag.
Totally.
But like burlesque, if we're doing it, like, I want
specifically is that. Yeah.
I want the, like, whatever, the razzle dazzle. And I was like, there was something about it. I mean, whatever. I don't mean to like shit on these people, but I was like, I don't want to watch this. I don't want to watch anything unless it is a little bit gayer than this. And I also felt that way. I was trying to watch Sex and the City, Allison, you know, just getting ready for it, the upcoming
season two of Che's Big Adventure.
Hell yeah. I can barely watch the original series because it's simply not, there's nary a drop of queerness.
It is the least queer thing.
And I can't
And there's like a queer storyline for Samantha for like two or three episodes, and it's still like deeply unqueer.
Right. It's, yes, the straightest woman trying to have sex with a woman. And I feel bad because I love Sex and the City, but I just feel like I'm in a state where I'm like, I don't want to see this. This isn't for me. I understand. I'm just, you know, processing this. And I always think of like myself as like when I first came out, I felt like I was 13, and now I feel like I've hit like 18, like when you enter college. And I'm like, this is my college rage of like,
I thought you were gonna say like 50. Like right to being like a like curmudgeonly 50, like I don't like any of this anymore, kind of like over it.
Yeah, that's where I'll end up. When I'm 50, I'll finally be caught up with myself. Well, that's enough time. But it's just interesting. I feel like that's also why I can't get off Twitter, is I just follow too many queer and trans people. And I'm like, I just need a little bit of it, of the discourse all day. And I can't.
Yeah. Especially when like, well, I think what sucks is like your promise, like it's a queer bar. It's like a objectively like pretty queer or should be queer, like performance style. And then it's like just very straight. That sucks. Like a false promise.
Yeah. So again, that's no offense to the burlesque community, but I was like, this, I demand queerness in this space, and I will not be attending. I'm doomed. It's LA. There's so many burlesque shows that are LA. Yeah. I don't know.
There used to be a lot here too. And I feel like there was always a lot of like mixed like burlesque and comedy. And it's like, that just like doesn't serve either performance style.
I agree. I have no interest in that. Like, I don't know. It's
hard to pivot from somebody being like, oh, I was at Whole Foods the other day. Blueberries cost more than a car. And then like a lady like using tassels to like shake her tits around. And you're like, both of this is wrong.
Yeah. Separately
for
great.
For this space.
Yeah. But, and then I always think of the burlesque community in the Chris Fleming, a very funny comedian, has a song about polyamorous couples. And I believe the title is, It's Never Who You Want to Be Polyamorous, Who's Polyamorous? And he's just talking, these are straight couples, obviously. I know plenty of queer polyamorous couples who are fun. But it's like, I should have known by the way you went on about how welcoming the burlesque community has been. And that's what I kept thinking. I was like, that's who this is by and for. And they deserve their space too, but it shouldn't be in here. Get the hell out of here.
Not a lesbian bar. Like,
again, I mean, there's plenty of lesbians there, but I'm like, there's the ratio.
It's just off. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah. I mean, listen, and when I go to a straight bar, I pretend to be straight. That's the way it should be, you know? No, I don't know. That was just like a moment of like, I guess we could have just gone to a regular bar and not have seen this, but now we know. Now we know better. Before we get started, we are being asked to plug our Patreon, which we also didn't explain. So basically, we joined the Crooked Network And we also separately, at least for the time being, have a Patreon.
Yes.
So the way it works is there are three different tiers. $5, this is support us and support our ongoing struggle with living in reality.
Yes, yes.
$10, you get that, the support, and then you get two bonus episodes a month that will also be on theme. And then for $20, yes. you will get
those. And no ads. You're listening to no ads.
And you also get video. So in case you're watching this on Patreon, you can watch a video of us just fucking serving looks. No, I just woke up.
Always wet.
Always a little wet. Always makeup smeared. And then for $20, you get all of the above, plus a ticket to our monthly live show, which is live virtually. So if you have any interest, you could check us out at
patreon.com/ruinedpodcast.
Hell yeah. So check it out if you like this. If you, you know, we have a large back catalog, as you are probably, again, if you're new, you're going through it, but we have even more on Patreon. So
there's even more. And we have promised that if we hit 1,000 Patreon members, which we are like frighteningly close to doing, that we will go and record episodes and videos and content and stay overnight at the Lizzie Borden house. So we're probably making that trip pretty soon. And if you guys join, like, you're just going to speed that process up. And I'm sure you want to see us pull out a Ouija board at a house where a child murdered her parents with an axe.
Or did she? I actually don't know. I think there's some
question. Unclear.
But yeah, I will terrorize Allison. She will be decapitated live on camera.
We'll see.
So thank you all for everyone who's part of our Patreon. Boy, it's been an interesting past year, I'd say. And we really appreciate you joining us and giving us your money and supporting, again, something I would be simply doing for free to Allison. If no one was listening. God, I mean, this idea started on GChat and has, I guess GChat still exists, but who's using it? Not us. If we're not using it, no one's using it. Am I wrong?
It's true. We're the people. I feel like I still chat with one or two people when I'm just like doing fuck all and avoiding writing. So.
And it's one of those people, Josh Gondelman.
It is.
Friend of the pod and a wonderful
perennially on GChat.
God bless him. But yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for being a part of our Patreon. And if you're considering it, go take a look, take a gander. Yeah. And again, if we get to 1,000, Allison will know a world of terror, the likes of which this planet has never known.
Cool.
So you got that going for you.
Can't wait.
So let's
wait. Before we get into it, we just want to let you guys know we have another live show coming up Sunday, May 21st, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. And we are doing Evil Dead Rise.
It's Mommy Issues Month, so there really is no bigger issue you could have with your mommies than if she becomes a deadite and is sleeping with the maggots now. So join us at moment.com/ruined.
moment.co/ruined.
Sorry.
I don't know why it's not a com. It should be a com, but moment.co/ruined is where you can buy your tickets and also where you'll go to watch the show. Obviously, Patreon members at the $20 tier, you already have tickets that will be in your inbox that morning. And it'll be another great live show. If you've been to other ones, you know that we have a blast and a half. We get a little blasted, and the chat's fun. There's merch. Like, just come.
please just attend.
Please just come.
We love you, and we'll see you there Sunday, May 21st.
Yes.
So let's keep it going. It is, of course, Mommy Issues Month.
Mommies.
We've talked a lot about daddies on this podcast, so we had to give mommies their month. Mommy issues, we all have them.
I mean,
all things funny when people are like, oh, I have mommy issues or daddy issues. I was like, baby, you have two parents, you know, or
they
more.
Can both fuck you up.
Yeah, you do have issues with both of them. Give me a break. Come on. Let's be honest here. But we are doing this week another fabulous David Cronenberg movie, The Brood. Which is interestingly based on his own divorce and custody battle with his wife.
Okay. A little personal.
And it does, I will say, it is, it came out in 1979, written and directed by David Cronenberg. And there are elements at the beginning where I feel like they do tip a sort of like, not necessarily a men's rights, but sort of like hit on some themes that now have been appropriated as men's rights. Mm-hmm. But I would actually argue that the movie is pretty even-handed about what's actually going on, which is more complicated. like, it has a monstrous female, it has a monstrous mother.
Sure.
But the reasons for that and the way that it happens, to me, like, I feel like this would be easy to say this was misogynistic, and a lot of horror movies are. This, to me, is more complicated, and I kind of appreciate it, because if you're making a horror movie about your ex-wife, it would be very easy to be recriminatory. I mean, that being said, we'll discuss how you feel about how we landed it.
Cool.
But yeah, so we'll be doing The Brood, and before we begin, we also have to have Allison watch the trailer. Allison, what are your thoughts about The Brood trailer?
I mean, absolutely chilling. I didn't like it. And like the trailer is, you know, like, it's not a trailer that gave me a real sense of what's going on in the movie. So that's even scarier, because you're just like, well, someone's up to something and it doesn't seem good. And a child seems like it was getting terrorized at one point, and I don't like that.
That's the problem with mommy issues about this.
Which now makes sense with the ties to his custody battle and divorce.
I will say, mommy issues month, I really shot myself on the foot here, because I just really wanted to take a break from, after we did political month, we did Cars of the Future. I'm like, I need to take a break from kids and horror, and this is all kids. I mean,
because
to be a mommy.
What are mommies if there are no children?
I mean, and this is a question is, what is a mommy if she has a different kind of child, Allison?
Okay.
I just want to read it. David Cronenberg has a quote. The Brood is my version of Kramer versus Kramer, but more realistic, which I think is fun. That's very fun. And then we also have to take a baseline scary. Allison, how scary do you find the concept of a brood?
What is that?
A brood is... Yeah, okay, so I was going to say it's birds, but as soon as I came to say it, yeah, here we go. It's a family of young animals, especially of a bird. So let's say, because famously,
like, it's a collective noun.
And so it's a little hatchlings and birds kind of just running around.
Oh,
so it's
very,
like a little, yeah.
Very. I don't like things that can skitter, and I feel like they're skittering.
Mm-hmm. We are skittering. We are scampering. There's
skittering,
a,
scampering.
There's a lot of ducking behind doorways in this movie.
Yes.
And then how scary do you find the concept of basically, I'm trying to think how to sum this up. How scary do you find the concept of a parent creating a child with a particular purpose?
Ooh, never good. Never good.
Yeah, the idea, and we'll talk about that at the end, because I think it connects to some stuff in the news, as every horror movie does, in terms of how we conceive of children as not simply their own being, but something to be created and controlled by their parents, which I don't know why we think that, but is not true.
They are human beings.
Yes, you could see, again, as... the conversation in America being about children is not for no reason. And it is because our ideas of what children are themselves very fucked up, but we'll get into it. And there's a bunch of fucked up kids in this movie.
Great.
So we'll get into it. Before we begin, Allison, would you like to guess the twist in The Brood?
Guess the twist.
I'm going to guess that The Brood has, a mother of it, and that all of the real terror is being directed by her, like large bird.
Okay, great. Thing. She is the mother,
or
bird.
Like whatever, whatever creature is the mother of the brood is the one that's like behind all of the evil that's happening.
Okay, great. I love it. Let us begin ruining the brood. We open on Dr. Hal Raglan. He's berating his patient Mike in front of an auditorium of people, which feels very 70s to perform psychotherapy in front of an audience.
Yes.
And this is also a critique, of course, of psychotherapy, about the process, and about a lot of stuff we were getting up to that maybe we didn't have to, you know? And he's, of course, berating his patient, Mike. They're role-playing. So Mike is playing his childhood self. Dr. Raglan is Mike's father. And he's berating Mike about not looking him in the eye. And Mike replies, "I could if I wanted to, Daddy." And is talking, calling him Daddy, not in a fun way, unfortunately, in a deeply traumatized way. And there are these, I don't think so much anymore, but these schools of thought that like the best way to get out of trauma is to replay it over and over again. And I think we're understanding that there are diminishing returns on that.
Yeah. I don't think that that's.
Yeah. You're not going to get out of it that way.
The path forward for healing.
Yeah. And in case you were unclear whether or not Dr. Ragland's methods were sound, he tells Mike, "I guess you're just a weak person. You get that from your mother. You're so weak, we should have named you Michelle. Weakness is more accepted in a girl." Also, no, it is not. I'll tell you, someone who was a girl, you are not allowed to be weak ever.
At all. Ever.
Ever. But of course, much like we talk about how queerness is a concept is created to also control straight people, the girl isn't a concept used to berate boys. You know, like it is used in that same way. Like, what are you going to be, a girl?
It's like, right. And it's like, that's the worst thing you can be.
Exactly. Which I also think is like, when we talk about trans stuff, it's like, that obviously is like part of it too, where it's like, what do you want to be, a girl? Like the worst thing in the world. It's like, okay. Well, a lot of us are. So I don't know why we have to talk about it like this, but of course that's part of it. So we see again, he is berating this obviously mentally ill man in front of an auditorium of other people. And we see our protagonist Frank enter and he sits down to watch. And Dr. Hal, he's continuing to berate Mike. He says, "I should call you Michelle all the time and treat you like a girl. I could buy you frilly scarves and frilly frocks. And you could be daddy's little girl." It's like, again, femaleness as a way to bully men into submission or into, I guess, more like tightening up. Mike screams, of course. He's like, "I hate you, daddy, because I love you and it makes me feel guilty." And Dr. Ragland says, "Don't tell me about your anger like a little girl. Show me." And Mike sort of hunches over and then tears off his shirt. And all over his body, Allison, we see these horrible, pus-filled red welts.
No. What? No.
Yeah. Ugh. And he's sobbing and he says, "Look at me, daddy. This is what you do to me inside." And he collapses into Dr. Ragland's arms. And Dr. Ragland hugs him and kisses him like a father would.
Okay.
And but then he tells him, "I see, Michelle. I see." And I wrote, psychotherapy in a nutshell in the 70s. Like, guys, we got to figure this out.
Ain't it?
Now it's like, oh, you just can't afford to go see anyone. So I guess that's what we decided on.
Just get it from TikTok.
Yeah. Thank you, TikTok. Oh my God. Absolutely. Like our only medical provider, provider of medical information. But the session ends and the guy next to Frank, he turns and he just blows a breath out and he goes, "That man is a genius." People are really wowed by this.
Okay.
Frank and the other attendees exit. Some go to their cars and some of them go, they have like a bus that takes you, I guess, back to the city. And they are at the Soma Free Institute of Psychoplasmics. Because this is a David Cronenberg movie, so you know you're getting a title like that.
Yes. Love that.
And I do say, it's like, if you were a white man with any authority, you could open an institute based on our history.
Yes.
Like, statistically, your chances of having an institute raises exponentially. Frank goes upstairs to one of the guest rooms to collect his daughter, Candace, who I'm going to say it's 4 or 5. I'm going to say 4. Mm-hmm. And they head out to his car. And she has this very, which you saw in the trailer, a signature red snowsuit. So, like, matching red and jacket and pants. At home, Frank is giving Candace a bath, and when she turns so he can wash her back, she's covered in bruises. Frank, reasonably enough, freaks the fuck out.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yes. So he goes back to the Institute, and again, I think this is, again, to signal, at least to the modern viewer, I hope this was the signal to the viewer at the time, Dr. Ragland is taking a shower. If you are a medical professional, you shouldn't be showering at the Institute.
An unnecessary boundary to cross.
Exactly. Yeah. And he is wearing a robe and is just fully in a robe talking to his lackey, Chris, which again, it's like, if your psychiatrist is in a robe, I think that it's like, what is the checklist of an actual like competent medical professional? Robe, you got to get out of there.
There is not, unless you're literally a burlesque performer backstage, there's not a profession I can think of that that not even requires a robe, but where it's even remotely acceptable to have exactly. one around.
Right. If any of us were to walk into our office soaking wet in a robe, it'd be like, okay, something's gone wrong.
Let's take her to the hospital.
You gotta get that out of here. Yeah. You gotta get the fuck out of here. Chris, his lackey, comes in and says, that guy Frank's here, and he's getting passionate about the whole thing. Passionate about someone hitting his kid? Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fair.
And Frank busts in, and he's furious because basically he says, I leave her alone. Like, the situation is Frank's ex-wife, or soon-to-be ex-wife, Nola, is an inpatient living at the Institute. Every weekend, he brings their daughter, and then she spends the weekend with her mother. So he's like, either my ex-wife did this, or somebody else staying here abused my child. I am not bringing her back here. And Dr. Ragland immediately starts downplaying his concerns. It's like, I'm sure there's some explanation for it. You know, I'm sure this is no problem. And you can't not bring your child because your wife is undergoing extensive therapy. Mm-hmm. And we cannot change her therapy at this time, which all seems very Scientology to me.
Very Scientology.
Like, once you completely take away, like, this conversation.
Any agency.
Not in it. Yeah.
And it's not like, and I understand that, like, mental health and, you know, other physical health issues are not that different. But at the same time, like, it's not like she's hooked up to a thing that's keeping her breathing. It's like, no. Yeah. We can find a way around this so that the child isn't in danger.
Exactly. Yeah. Frank says, well, fuck you. Somebody hit my kid and is either, again, my ex-wife or somebody else staying here. Yeah. So I'm not bringing her. Dr. Ragland says separating her could send your ex-wife in over the deep end. And again, I question the medical ethics of a man telling that to someone's ex-husband. Like, just don't say that. Don't describe it in that way. It reminded me of Lewis, the chiropractor in Jacob's Ladder, who tells Jake
no that boundaries.
His ex-wife is still in love with him. It's like, you can't just say that while you're doing something medical. But again, that seems like that's what the 70s was.
Yeah, it feels like extremely blurred lines across the board.
But Dr. Ragland does say you have no legal right to deny Nola access to Candace, which is fair. I mean, she is allowed to see her. But Frank says, if you want to fight me in court, let me know. I'll fucking go to court with you right now. I don't care. And Dr. Ragland, who again is in a robe, which might as well just have his dick and balls hanging out. Like, it is the most insane, inappropriate,
unacceptable.
And he said, I know that I was with Noel all weekend. I know she didn't hit Candace, so there must be some other explanation. And again, Frank says, great, you give me that fucking explanation. Until then, my daughter is not coming back here, which seems fair. Like, yeah, you sort this out. I am not bringing my daughter back here because something is going on here.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, then Dr. Ragland calls Chris and says, prepare Nola. Her name is Nola Carvith Kelly.
Okay.
I know. It's David Cronenberg. I mean, yeah. These are the most normal David Cronenberg names we've run across so far.
Yeah, this makes Crimes of the Future. This is like Sally, Mary.
Crimes of the Past. Frank goes to his lawyer and basically says, this institute is a quackery. Psychoplasmics is a fake field of science. It's like my ex-wife is in a facility that is not only hit my kid, but I don't even believe in it. She's been in there. I don't think she's getting better. I didn't even talk to her, you know?
Right.
And Barnes says, I hear what you're saying. And I think this probably happens a lot where it's like, Dr. Ragland is like a licensed institute. He's a real psychiatrist and Nola checked herself in. She's allowed to do that. And then he said, which to me is the men's rights part of it all, which is you're going to have a hard time because the law believes in motherhood. And that's fine.
Okay.
As sort of an explanation why you immediately wouldn't escalate this.
Yes.
But also the rest of the movie isn't really necessarily about that or about the law. So I feel like it's just put in there in a way that if you put that in a movie now, it would feel much more political. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not to excuse the point, but rather it's like, that's not really what we're talking about.
Right. That's not what this is about. Yeah.
Right. What it's about is Frank trying to prove that this kind of psychiatric care is fictional.
Fake.
Yeah. So it's like, this guy's a quack, much like Scientology, or unfortunately, there's a lot of different cults where people like make medical promises. Mm-hmm. Goddamn Gwyneth Paltrow out here sucking down bone broth, looking like the goddamn Crypt Keeper. You know, everyone, unfortunately, if they're vulnerable, could be put in the hands of people who do not have their best interests in heart. at heart. And boy, this Dr. Raglan has some plans that are not in anyone's best interest. And his lawyer says, that's fine if you want to do that. But next weekend, if you don't show up, that Nola could have the police come and take your kid. Like you could lose custody for denying her custody. So all of this happens in a matter of a week. Because Frank's like, I have to fucking figure this out. I'm not taking her back there. I will find evidence. So now he's sort of, that's his project. And we see Frank pick up Candace at school. And you see all the kids sort of spill out of the playground. They all have their little brightly colored snowsuits because it's in Canada and it's during the winter. And it's really cute. And we meet Candace's teacher, Ruth Mayer, who sort of talks to Frank as an aside and said, I'd love to be with you. You weren't able to make it to parent-teacher, but I have some concerns. And I think we're supposed to think Candace is sort of suffering at school because of the divorce, because of her mother's ongoing, you know, mental illness and trying to get treatment. Obviously, you're four. The whole thing's very overwhelming. You know, talk to your children again. Barely a concept now, I'm sure, in the 70s, revolutionary. But Frank takes Candace to see Nola's mother, Juliana, who is fully drinking a glass with no ice of what I assume is warm scotch in the middle of the day.
I mean, live out loud, girl.
Not even one ice cube? I can't understand it.
Yeah.
What, are you a cowboy? And she immediately tells Frank,
I guess you don't know what it feels like being a parent. Being blamed for everything. To have the past distorted so you don't even recognize yourself in it. Your child's version of the past, that is.
And it's like, yes, distorted, remembered correctly, and that's why your daughter's in a mental institute. Who's to say which it is? And there is this idea, again, that I think is the movie is questioning, where it's like, you can never question your parents, like, right, or their authority, which is like, yeah, girl, you're getting blamed for stuff that you obviously did, and we know you did it, starting with the fact that you are drunk in the middle of the day.
Yes.
Like, that's
reeks of guilt.
Yeah, like, exactly. And Frank says, well, you know, my daughter's only five, and so we're going to work on that. I don't think we're going to get where you and Nola are at. And Juliana says, she's working on it right now, believe me. And then looks at Candace with this level of, like, malice, which there is something to that where it's, like, parents who think of their children as, like, not competitors, but something where it's, like, betrayal is like they're going to betray me by being their own person.
Yeah.
Having their own thoughts and feelings, you know, like adversaries or in some regard, except one of them is a literal child and the other one is adult. Grow up, everybody. And she says, 30 seconds after you're born, you have a past. 60 seconds after that, you start to lie to yourself about it. It's like 60 seconds is also the amount of time it took you to drop down that fucking drink in the middle of the day while watching your grandchild.
Oh, warm scotch.
You know, but that's what's the thing is like she's not accepting any blame whatsoever for her role. And this is about like the cycle of trauma in Nola's family and how this is going to be visited on her daughter and her ex-husband, you know, and Frank interrupts her and was like, okay, like obviously he's heard this before. Like, okay, that's fine. But then he's going to leave Candace with Juliana while he goes to try to research the facility, you know, and go to his actual job.
Yes.
And he
keep
leaves.
Everybody flush with scotch.
Exactly. And she tells her granddaughter, let's look at these old family photos. Let me just get a refill. She's constantly getting a refill there's not a drop of soda. There's not even ice to break it up. She's just drowning scotch. Meanwhile, back at the Institute, we see Dr. Raglan doing a session with Nola. Dr. Raglan's pretending to be Candace, and he's talking to Nola about her being hit. And he tells her, you hurt me, mummy. And Nola says, no, mummies don't do that. Mummies don't hurt their own children. And Dr. Raglan says, oh, they never do? And of course, Nola then has to be like, oh, right, I was abused.
Mm-hmm.
And by my mother. And so she's sort of like, she said, they're fucked up. Those are fucked up mummies like mine was. And then he switches into her mother. So now Dr. Raglan is Juliana.
Okay.
And he
tells psychiatric practice is like role play of parenting?
It is improvisation. It is horrifying to watch. Both just as because it seems so unsound and also because have you seen improv?
Yeah.
I did improv for years and I'm allowed to say that. Of course. It's insane. And then so he's playing her mother now. And he's like, no, Nola, I would never do that. I would never hurt you. Mummies never hurt their children. And she explodes. And Nola's like, you did. You beat me. You scratched me. So again, it's like the repeating cycles of abuse. So it's like, can she recognize within herself that the cycle's repeating.
Yeah.
Because saying to her own mother, you threw me down the stairs, you know? And Dr. Rogan says, that's good. Show me your anger. Go all the way through it to the end, right to the end. Like, get to the end of your anger. Let it out. Back at Juliana's, Candace holds up a photo of her mother, Nola, who's in the hospital as a child with her mother, you know, and asks, why was my mummy in the hospital so much? And Juliana, who's drinking at this point a fucking camelback of scotch, she's like, you know, when your mother was a child, she'd wake up with bumps all over her skin and the doctors could never figure it out. Meanwhile, Allison, we see that there is, I thought it was a dumbwaiter. It looks like it's a delivery slot for orange juice and milk. I don't know if that was ever a thing, but that's what it looks like.
Explain to me what that means.
So there's a little door you
open. I know what a dumbwaiter is, but like, how is it so specific?
It looks like the milkman comes and opens a door in the side of your apartment, in this case, or house, and puts the milk in and then closes the door. And then you open the door from the other side to get the milk.
Okay.
I don't know why that makes more sense than just leaving the milk on your doorstep. I guess you don't knock it over.
It's protected.
And it does look delicious, and I absolutely would love to receive milk that way. But also, I thought it was a dumbwaiter. It's like, as soon as you see a dumbwaiter in a horror movie,
you're like, well, someone's coming up and down with just a head.
Exactly. Yes, separate head.
Yes.
And so, it's a delivery hatch for orange juice and milk. And we see a child-sized fist just punch the door open from the outside. And the child's arm is wearing Candace's snowsuit. So it's a snowsuit exactly like Candace. So this is, again, it'd be like a little child avatar who's here to, like, kick ass. Juliana hears it but thinks, oh, I must have stacked the dishes and they fell over. Let me go check. And, well, they're going to freshen both of our drinks. Meanwhile, Candace is drinking like milk. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm going to make us another cocktail. It's like, girl, you have to watch a five-year-old child. Unfortunately, as she walks to the kitchen, she hears glass shattering. It sounds like something or someone is running across her kitchen counter.
Okay. We and don't Allison, love it.
We see a tiny, wizened hand grabbing a meat tenderizer. Which makes you think, how hard did meat used to be? I've never owned a meat tenderizer.
I've never owned one. The only time I've ever really needed one is to make, like, thin chicken cutlets. And you could just buy them thin now. Like, you don't even need to, pound out a breast. So
yeah, I think you should have to do a little work. You should have to chew a little bit, America. You know what I mean?
A little bit.
And Juliana walks in the kitchen, it is wrecked, their dishes smashed, cereal spilled everywhere, and there's a broken window.
Okay.
She looks up, Allison, and sitting on top of the fridge, wielding the meat tenderizer, is a child, sort of. And we don't see it directly, we just see it sort of outlined, and it leaps onto Juliana, and it takes the meat tenderizer, and it brutally beats her to death. Unfortunately, poor baby Candace then has to come in and discover her grandmother's dead body.
And drunk.
And she was drunk on top of it. And
I mean, imagine being drunk and like a small thing bludgeons you to death. That's scary. That's even more confusing.
Okay, but I would argue at least you got a little buzz on.
Yeah, right. You're kind of like loosey-goosey.
It's like how drunk people are more likely to...
Survive a car crash. Because they're not as like rigid.
Now, I don't know what the statistics are for surviving a child creature.
Pulverization,
but the statistics are not in her favor.
No, she's gone.
And we see Candace looks up and sees there's a child. The child creature is holding onto the banister and it runs upstairs, leaving these bloody tiny handprints below. We see Frank arrive at work. He is an architect. It's been a minute since we've had the seminal men's horror movie
architect
career represented architect. And Frank arrives at the apartment building, and just then he gets a call from Sergeant Markle, who you could go ahead and picture as Meghan Markle. It's not, but it's just kind of fun.
No, that's more fun, though.
If it adds something for you.
It does.
And unfortunately, they tell him that a police officer, I guess, saw the broken window as he was going by, goes inside and finds Juliana dead and Candace asleep in bed.
Oh.
And he says, you know, I'm having her talk to Dr. Birkin, our child psychologist here at the police station. And, you know, of course, Frank immediately panics and thinks, well, did she see it happen? Is she acting unusually? And he's like, no, she's acting calm and cool, a little too cool. Allison, they think that baby might have did it. So my question to you is, what would you do?
What would you do?
I mean, let's get that baby questioned, you know? Let's see what she saw, what she knows, and then keep everyone locked in separate rooms and facilities. And then no one gets to see anyone and no one else has to die.
Great. And that's, I mean, it seems like that's what we're trying to do in society. It's not working out great, but I guess it's hard to, as a parent, know what you'll do in any particular situation.
Yeah.
And this is one where my immediate instinct would be just to fight the police on everything. Like, yeah,
I mean, obviously.
But then you look more guilty, and then it's sort of, that's a difficult thing, especially because this is one of, just the beginning of the murders in this film. But we see Sergeant Markles talking, you know, about the brutality of the crime, and he says it didn't seem like an interrupted break-in or, say, a rape murder. It's like, wow, just to have that phrase thrown out.
That phrase is tough.
Just a rape murder.
It gives me, like, obviously it's the same as, like, murder hornet. You're like, enough.
Yeah.
This is too much.
Bad enough. A rape murder. And I had the captions on it. It was rape hyphen murder. So, and also just unfortunate that that's just a category of murder.
Yes. It's just hard to hear. It's just a little subset of a horror.
And they started asking, did she have any enemies? This seems particularly personal. And Frank says, well, Juliana had a series of lovers, but I never met them, which I do think is cool. And she said her ex-husband is Barton Kelly, who is Nola's father. He works for the government in Halifax, but they've been divorced for 10 years and he doesn't live here. Like, you know, so I don't think it would be him. And Dr. Bergen comes in, the child psychologist, and says, okay, yes. So your kid absolutely saw this murder, but now she's so traumatized that she has retroactive amnesia. She doesn't even remember going to her grandmother's, let alone seeing anything. So it's important that you get her to try to talk about it. And Frank's like, and again, this is something we've talked about, like, is it better to confront your trauma and talk about it? Or is it better to, as we would have in the 70s, just bottle everything up and teach your child that if horrible things happen, you never speak of them. But there is some pushback on that. Dr. Bergen says, I've seen children with ulcers as bad as adults from unprocessed trauma. And I think we now know that ulcers are just bacteria?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bacteria.
Yeah. It's not like from like, it's not your body like making something out of contained stress and anxiety in the way that we used to be like, oh, I'm so stressed out, I have an ulcer. It's like, well, that's probably connected to some things that are happening in your life that then allowed bacteria to grow in a space. Not necessarily that like your work stress is coming out of your stomach hole.
Right, yeah. And we do feel a lot of our emotions in our stomach. So it would make sense that it's like, oh, no, my stress feels like it's in my stomach. It must be causing. But then it's like stress does have physical effects on our health, you know. So it's six of one, half dozen of the other, I suppose. Yes. Frank takes Candace home to put her to bed. She can't even talk. And I just feel so bad because she's such a little tiny bean.
I know.
She's such a little baby. And so again, it's like, not that I want a 9-year-old to have to go through this, but have a 4 or 5, like a 5-year-old go through
so
it.
Oh, so tiny.
And it's so teeny. And so the phone rings. He runs to get it after putting her down, and he misses the call. And we see the person calling is Nola, his ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And we see Chris, the lackey, is hanging it up, the phone out of her hand. And she says, is something wrong? Something feels wrong. Something is absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Raglan appears and then he enters and he immediately is like, it's daddy. Like, it doesn't even, there's not even a second to acknowledge anything could be wrong. Immediately, we're back into the role play. And now he's playing Nola's father, Barton, who we're going to meet in a minute here. And she's like, Frank despises me. He's trying to take Candace away from me so I'll never see her. And Dr. Raglan, you know, again, pushes back. Is like, well, what if he doesn't want to see her hurt? What he wants is for the best for your daughter, the same way that I, as your father, protected you as a child. And she says, no. And Dr. Regan pushes back and says, no what? It's like, you didn't protect me. You didn't protect me, Daddy, and you should have. And again, now she's unleashing this intense rage at her father, where she's like, you shouldn't have looked away when she hit me. You should have stopped her. And she says, which I think, you know, anyone who's suffered abuse, like that's at the bottom of the question is, well, didn't you love me? Like, why didn't you step in and do something? You saw, she threw me down the fucking stairs, you know? And unfortunately, because Raglan's not her actual father, he doesn't really have a response to that. back at home, we see that Frank is documenting the bruises on Nola's back with a Polaroid to unfortunately build a case as part of the case against the Institute. Like, she was there. Yes. News happened. Fuck this. Right. I have this evidence, you know, which yes, unfortunately.
Here's a photo. Yeah.
Yeah. And I am so sorry to anyone who's ever had to do anything like that. Like, that's so horrifying to have to think of building a fucking case to prove something like that happened. Hmm. And now it's time to plan the grandmother's funeral. So it's like bad. And they go to the airport to pick up Barton, who is Candace's grandfather, so they can plan the funeral. Okay. Like, her parents are still alive. They're going to want to come in. Her brother's going to want to come in. You know, we could do it this weekend, you know, but he's staying in a hotel, but he's thinking about going back to the family home, which is where Juliana lives. So she stayed at the family home after they broke up. It's the family home where Nola was raised.
Okay.
And he has not been back there, you know, but it's, you know, it is furnished and empty. And he's already like, going back there's going to be really hard. I don't know how I feel about it. And Frank's like, I've got a lot to deal with right now. I can't take on your shit.
No, his plate is pretty fucking full.
Like, I know you are my ex-father-in-law, but I'm going to need you to handle yourself for like 2 minutes here. Frank goes to a residential facility to see one Mr. Jan Hertog, who is a former patient of the Soma Free Institute of Psychoplasmics. And we see Jan is rolling around on the ground in his room. It looks like it's sort of like a, I don't want to say halfway house, but like a residential facility for people to stay after they leave.
Yes.
You know, like an inpatient
another institute support. Or an, yeah.
Yeah, like a rehab, but you're just, for, it's just living, like a dorm sort of. And so he's rolling around on a mat with a towel around his neck. And he's telling Frank, who you know, is kind of flummoxed about what to do. He says, people talk about blood, but no one talks about the lymphatic system. Blood has the heart to pump it, but there's no muscle that pumps lymphatic fluid. So it only moves when we exercise. And if you have a problem with your system, the whole thing gets fucked up. And basically, he's blaming Dr. Ragland for fucking up his lymphatic system.
Okay.
And Frank says, my wife is in the Institute and her... I want to assume for psychological damages, but you sound like you have physiological damage, you know?
Yes.
And they sort of chat and we find out that their lawyers are friends. So Jan is working on like a patient class action lawsuit against the Institute. And Frank, you know, so sort of they're sort of communicating. And Jan says, give him a little more time with your wife and she'll have physiological damage too, I promise you. Oof. And we see Jan pull his neck towel down, revealing what looks like a sea anemone.
What?
Like growing out of his throat.
No.
And it is a Cronenbergian representation of lymphosarcoma, which is, of course, cancer of the lymph system. Mm-hmm. And it's spreading. And Frank, in a way that makes this the most grounded David Cronenberg, one of them, is like, you're going to really blame that guy for this?
Fair.
And your doctor thinks you can prove that in court? I was like, I can't remember a movie we watched where anyone's asking reality-based questions like
yes,
that.
Yes, right, where it's like, that's not this. Like, that's not how this works.
Yeah, so that's kind of a fun twist on his... To be more grounded in this movie, I thought it was really fun. And Jan's like, no, I don't think I can prove it. It's like metaphysics. I know what happened, but I can't fucking explain it. But what I want to go to court for is I want to torch this place's reputation.
Yes.
Whether I could lose, but I want everyone to, I mean, now they didn't have Google, but basically like if you were to Google the name of this institute, it's this fucking lawsuit.
Yes.
So it's like, I want as many people on it as possible and fuck, I want to ruin his name. And I was like, that's actually very smart and what you have to do if that kind of shit happened. It's like, yeah, I might lose because that's how the legal system is set up.
But just getting it out there as like a question for people will end up
deter
like bringing it down.
Yeah. Frank is thoroughly weirded out by the whole conversation and leaves. Meanwhile, we see Barton, the grandfather, has driven to the Institute to try to tell Nola that her mother has been murdered. She doesn't even know yet. And he is drinking in his car. So he is also, much like his ex-wife, drinking, again, like you said, the guilt of what they've done and what level of denial they have. And he's drunk. He gets out and he accosts Dr. Ragland and Chris as they leave the Institute and says, I need to tell Nola her mother has been murdered. And Dr. Ragland refuses. He says Nola is in a critical phase of therapy. And Barton, of course, both being drunk and being an enraged grandfather, grabs Raglan's lapels and shakes him. It's like, if I don't hear from my daughter by tomorrow afternoon, I'm coming to check her out of your fucking facility. And Chris says, do you want me to like call the cops as Barton drives away? And Dr. Raglan says, nah, he's drunk. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Meanwhile, Frank goes to pick up Candace from school and invites the teacher, Miss Ruth Mayer, over for dinner. She's also a smoke show. So I think this sort of like, oh, is this perhaps another chance at love? Yes, a lot of people are being murdered, a lot of mayhem, but you
still,
never know.
You can be hot and people can be murdered. Those two things are not exclusive.
I mean, isn't that the way of the world? You know
what
I mean? That's the only thing keeping us going is hot people. And she tells him at dinner at his home, he says, basically every time we have any free time, Candace wants to play mother-daughter. So she wants me to be her mother. And they talk about, you know, sort of the teacher said that. And she's like, I just want to check in. I know her mother is in some sort of institute. And I just wanted to let you know, it seems like maybe she needs more support. And Frank says, yeah, I'm really sort of realizing it's sort of the mistake of my marriage. And I think looking back that Nola married me for my sanity. And that was what was appealing about it. And it didn't.
I would marry a man if he's sane.
I mean,
I have yet to meet one.
Yeah, someone who will never date a man again. I'll say it does take a minute. It takes a minute and it takes a village.
Yeah.
To find a man to marry for his sanity.
With sanity.
And I want that for you, Allison.
Yeah, sure.
It's going to happen.
I got Riz. I'm fine.
Yeah. So the phone rings. It's Barton. He is, of course, drunk as hell. And he's back at the family house. So Juliana's place, which is still a crime scene. Like there is tape everywhere.
Right.
There's literally the outline of her body taped onto the kitchen floor. And he's just in a stupor. He's like, I'm so depressed. Yeah. Like he's spiraling. And Frank, of course, is thinking, please, I just have so much going on right now. But he says, I want to go drive to the Institute tonight to spring my daughter out of there. And I want you to go with me. So we'll go as soon as you get here. And Frank says, okay, I'll come pick you up. But really, he's just going to pick him up and bring him home. He doesn't want Barton to be driving drunk.
No.
To the Institute.
Right.
You know?
Fresh off of like a huge, like life altering trauma.
Yeah. And literally we see Barton like on the floor, like running his hands along the body, the outline of the body. I know. So he's much
We're not
like
going pranking tonight. Like that's not happening.
And Ruth says, if you want me to watch Candace, that's totally fine. He says, it'll be 45 minutes. I'll drive there and come right back. Also, if you want to read this book, and he gives her Dr. Raglan's book, which is called The Shape of Rage, and sort of an introduction to psychoplasmics. And he leaves. And meanwhile, we see Barton. He's sobbing. He's like going up the stairs and he collapses into Juliana's bedroom and he's sobbing and he's apologizing. He's like, I'm sorry, Juliana. I never meant it to be this way. Okay. And unfortunately, Barton, if you think you're sad now, we see a little hand start crawling
Not a little hand.
The bed, Allison. Wearing that signature, that fire red coat, and it reaches up onto the side table, grabs a heavy glass paperweight.
They've got too much stuff for murder around this house.
I don't,
meat pulverizers, heavy blunt objects, like...
I'm looking around. I guess probably like the microphone arm is the only thing you could beat me to death with in this room.
Yeah,
oh,
like
no,
I have
my toolbox.
Look, I have kitchen stuff. It's all in drawers. It's all away. Like nothing's just like out for small hands to grab.
And this small hand makes quick work because he just motherfucking beats him to death.
Oh,
I didn't mean to gender the child. I don't know what, you know, I think these child transcend gender. Barton is beaten brutally to death with this glass paperweight. Unfortunately, this time when Frank makes it there and finds Barton's corpse, again, brutally murdered, he sees the child leap out from the shadows of the bedroom and we get our first look at its face.
Oh, no.
And it looks sort of like a distorted mask of a child over a child's mask.
Oh.
Over a child's face.
Great.
And it hurls the paperweight at Frank.
How
so
large?
Hard. It's like the size of a child.
The size of a child.
So,
like a size
like a five-year-old.
Of the other child. Okay.
Yeah, so not very big. Hypothetically, I'm like, if you were to kick this child really hard, it would fly across the room. And nobody does. And it makes I just think people have to be prepared. As we discussed before, if there's an evil child, You have to physically fight the child.
Yeah,
I'm not
you have
happy
to fight a child.
Either.
And you can, and you just need to get over the mental block of I shouldn't kick a child across the room, because you're correct. You should not. But if it's right. An evil little thing that's already killed two adults, I think you can put yourself there.
It hurls the paperweight at Frank so hard it goes into the drywall. Great. And then he's just brawling with this little bastard who almost strangles him, but then finally lets go and just falls to the floor and dies, which is also baffling.
That's strange.
At the police station, the police came and like again cordoned off the crime scene again. And the detective tells Frank that the child was in the house the entire time. So it's probably hiding under the bed, hiding in the bedroom. Meanwhile, Miss Ruth Mayer answers the phone at Frank's place, assuming it's Frank calling with an update. It's in fact Nola calling from the Institute.
Okay.
And she's like, who the fuck is this? And Ruth says it's Ruth Mayer. And she says, oh my God, from the school? Are you having a private PTA meeting with my husband? You're killing my family, you bitch.
Oh my God.
And just goes off.
So she knows now.
She knows.
Okay.
She knows, and things are going from bad to worse. Basically, okay. It's like, it couldn't be a worse person to answer the phone. And listen, for young people, this is the kind of call you would actually get before cell phones. The phone rang, it picked it up. It could be anybody.
Anybody. You have no idea.
So unfortunately now Nola knows that Frank is moving on. Frank is perhaps she could just be babysitting Candace. Like that doesn't seem insane. Like stepping in during a very trying time. Over in the morgue, the mortician does the autopsy of the child creature while Frank watches, which is again, another hallmark of horror where it's like, that would not happen.
Yeah.
He would not be allowed in there. Especially because this is not a actual child, Allison. This is a creature.
Oh, no. Nope.
It has irises, but no retina. Its tongue is too thick and too immobile for speech.
No.
It has no teeth, but it has a beak.
It has a beak?
Have you ever seen like a squid? Like a squid has a beak?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like that, where like it has like a mouth, but inside of it
is
hard.
A beak.
It's okay. Hard. Yes.
Hard mouth.
Hard mouth. No sexual organs. And it has a food. They were trying to explain, why did it suddenly collapse and die? Well, Allison, it doesn't really have, it can't digest anything. So it has a sack of nutrient fluid between its shoulder blades.
Okay.
And once it burns through that and consumes that, it just dies of starvation.
Like a fruit fly.
So very fortunately, I guess it happened to die of starvation seconds away from strangling Frank to death.
What are
so
the odds?
Left out. And they said, and there's something even more strange. There's nothing more strange than that.
This is the strangest thing I've heard in a very long time.
Ooh, okay. So like, I'll have you guess. He said, that's not the strangest thing. The strangest thing is, Allison, what's the strangest thing about this body?
I'm going to get, my logical guess is same bruises as the child.
That's really good. That would have been great. No, it has no navel.
Thing has no belly button.
That's right. And that means this creature has never really been born. At least not the way human beings are born.
It wasn't ever born. I hate that.
You hate to hear it, Allison. It wasn't ever born. Back at the Institute, Nola is now convinced that Ruth Mayer is the reason her family is splitting up. She, again, like, look, in a trying time, who to blame, you know? Dr. Ragland tries to push back at her, but she sort of is committed to this. Frank arrives home and Ruth says, hey, just so you know, your insane ex-wife called. I'm leaving. Candace is upstairs. Bye. So she's out.
Yeah.
And Frank tells Candace, again, what can a five-year-old understand? But he tells her that the creature who killed her grandma, and also her grandfather, is dead. And she hugs him. And I'm like, I guess that would be of some solace. But the concepts behind what is being said is so fucked up and complicated. Like, can a five-year-old understand what that means?
I barely understand it, and I'm almost 40.
Right. Versus you are safe and something horrible happened, but I will be here
we
for
will
you.
Keep you safe.
And that is the thing too of like, can you keep your child safe? Like, that's the other horror of this movie.
This environment.
No. This Frank's doing his best. It doesn't matter. You can't come up against the brood, baby. Back over at the Institute, Raglan reads about the second murder in the newspaper, and there's a full-on photo of the child creature in it.
Imagine opening up the paper and seeing that and being like, I got to worry about this now and inflation.
I know. It's like, for the love of God. Also, I'd be like, I don't know that guy. That kid's not coming to my house.
Yeah.
That's somebody else's problem. That could happen tomorrow, Allison. We wouldn't be talking about it 4 days later. It would be over. Twitter would have moved on.
No, we'd be back on Scandoval.
Exactly. Like, it would be like, yeah, that makes sense. Like all the alien stuff. It's like, yeah, aliens. Oh, yeah. Who the fuck? What can we even do with that information at this point? Yeah. You know, what would you do
nothing.
And he tells Chris, the lackey, clear everyone out of the Institute now. They are emptying all the patients out of the facility. Because now we are understanding from his reaction, he recognizes what this is. And he wants to start hiding what is happening in a more overt way. So he's kicking all 27 residents out of the Institute. And Chris says, oh boy, Mike's not going to like this. Mike being the guy for the opening with the daddy issues.
Oh,
which
well.
I did think it was funny to be like, oh, Mike's going to have a hard time. It's like, Mike's, yeah, he was already having a hard time. And Raglan says, then do it gently. And when Chris goes to leave to kick all of their patients abruptly out of their care, Raglan opens his desk drawer, baby, and there's a gun inside.
Obviously.
Allison, please tell me who will survive this film.
Survive.
I think Dr. Raglan's definitely going to die because he's doing something wrong. So
We've got Nola, the ex-wife.
Nola. I think Nola will die. Frank will survive. Candace is the kid, right?
Yeah, Candace
will survive. I can't. Yeah.
We got Ruth Mayer, the teacher.
I think Ruth is going to survive and end up with Frank.
Okay, great. And that's pretty much it because we got the other
patients. Yeah, there's some other folks floating around, but they're not. Yeah. Mike, I guess, is probably not long for this world.
We see a scene of Mike pleading with Chris as they're just loading all the patients on the bus, which, again, is also like a question of like deinstitutionalization. Like when you put people out of an institute, even one that is clearly fucked up, where do they go?
Destabilizing. And yeah.
And so Mike is pleading with Chris, like, please don't make me get on the bus. But of course, Chris forces everyone to. And the next day, Frank heads over to see Jan, and he's really excited about the Institute emptying out because he thinks that's evidence that they know something is fucked up. So we can, like, this is going to be good for us. All these patients will want to talk to us about bringing a lawsuit. Like, these are 27 people ready to sign on.
Yeah.
In fact, I have one right here. It's Mike. We get a little more Mike, you know?
Good for Mike.
Yeah, more screen time, better pay for the actor who played Mike. And he tells Frank, basically, Nola is the only patient that's going to be left at the Institute. And Frank says, why would he not also empty her out of it? Like, why would she be the only one? And Mike tells Frank, Nola's the queen bee. She's a star. He's the one she's interested in. She was born to prove psychoplasmics was, what did Dr. Raglan call it? The ultimate therapeutic tool.
Ultimate then, feels wrong.
Yeah,
ultimate feels very end of the line.
Yeah. And he asked Frank, while I'm here, would you be my daddy? My real daddy rejected me. My surrogate daddy rejected me. And nobody did it better than Dr. Raglan. He knows that I'm addicted to him and he doesn't care. So will you be my daddy? And Jan says, anyways, everyone has been thrown out of the Institute except your wife. And Frank says, but why? And Mike screams, because Dr. Raglan wants to be alone with your wife. Like, do I have to spell it out with you?
Yeah,
you?
What do you think is going on in there, bro?
Nothing good. Like, that's whatever for sure. It is, it's bad, dude. Back at the Institute, we know what's going to be bad because Dr. Raglan is inspecting what I would describe as a nearly windowless barn.
Oh, cool.
With one window that is shattered, something clearly has escaped through the glass.
Oh, I'm sure wizened little creatures that were never born never hang out in windowless barns.
It's just good that the property came with a windowless barn. Really worked out for him and his practice. And he's so distraught by seeing the window that, of course, he takes out his gun. So in case you weren't clear how bad that sign was, he now is wielding a gun against something that he knows is in there, right?
Yeah.
Frank takes Candace to school. At least she's safe at school and sort of watches all the kids go inside while this other mom comes to talk. Wendy comes to talk to Frank. And we see all the kids inside. And again, I don't know why we are going to do a month of no kids in any horror movies. Because I'm just like not mentally there.
Child-free month.
And we see all the kids like take their coats off and get ready for the day. And everyone has a different snowsuit. And then we see two kids from behind. They're not kids, Allison. We see them grab Candace and
what do
shove
they wear?
Her.
Like
they're all wearing
snowsuits. Are they all
snow
in the same?
They're like, okay. They look, they're just different colors.
Okay.
So how the colors are chosen, do they generate the clothes? Yeah, are they just like given the clothes?
More questions than answers, for sure.
I guess, well, we'll talk about that at the end, yeah. And they shove Candace in the bathroom. They then both grab mallets, clay mallets. You shouldn't have mallets around in school, I think.
No.
Or anywhere outside of a place where clay is expressed. Well, I guess they are using clay. All right. Never mind. You should have mallets in school. And they brutally beat Miss Ruth Mayer in front of all of the horrified kindergartners who watch in silent terror as they beat her about the head. And finally, one little boy runs outside to find finds Frank and Wendy, who run inside. And they find Miss Mayer, and she is dead. Not only is she dead, Allison, Candace is missing. Frank has been outside for 30 fucking seconds.
It's like a child's gone, the hottie's dead. What's happening?
Back at the Institute, we see that Dr. Ragland has moved Nola into the first floor of the barn, basically.
Great.
And he's wearing like the fattest, like, you know, like, I feel like in the 90s too, I guess it was the 70s thing, ribbed white turtlenecks.
Yes. The 70s and the 90s both dipped into this knitwear trend.
It looks like he's like in a cocoon. Like it's the fattest, most ribbed turtleneck I've ever seen. And he wakes up. He wakes up Nola, who tells him, I had a dream. She said, I had a dream that my daughter was coming back to me. And he asked, well, what about Ruth Mayer? The last time we talked, you seemed pretty upset about her talking to your husband. And Nola smiles and says, you know, I must be doing really well because I don't feel threatened by her at all.
Hmm.
So again, what does that mean? We'll find out. Frank takes the police to a little studio where Nola and Candace, they live for 9 months after Nola left him. But of course, there's no one there, and he's trying to figure out like where would he's thinking that Candace just ran away in terror. So he's like, I don't know. She doesn't know anywhere else. She knows here in my house and her home, and that's it. Like there's no other options. Fortunately, Allison, we then see where she is. We see the two little child creatures, each holding her hand, just walking her down a snowy street. Okay. And we see, like in the country, like obviously towards the Institute.
Right.
And a truck drives by. It's like these, if I saw 3 5-year-olds holding hands like across
walking
like a lane
alone.
Of traffic in a snowstorm because it's now started to snow, you gotta stop.
No, you gotta stop.
Back at home, I will say the only acting problem I had with this is that back at home, Frank is like drinking coffee. He's reading the paper. If my kid's teacher was beaten to death and my child was missing, I would be vomiting. I would be running.
Is he not aware of? He's aware of those things.
He's aware of it to the point where he opens up the newspaper. And I guess this is back when they did like a morning edition, evening edition.
I mean, I would search the paper for answers.
You got to look. I mean, you got to look.
There's no Google, so.
They even, but it's the evening edition. So they have a, have you seen me? They were able to print a have you seen me of Candace. So that is at least in the paper.
Okay.
People are looking. There's a knock at the door and it's, you better believe it's Daddy Issues Mike. Mike is getting more screen
time. Hell yeah.
And he says, someone's following me. Someone's always following me. Mm. And Frank says, okay, Mike, that you gotta maybe rein it in here. But did you find out anything more about why they kicked everyone out of the Institute? And Mike says, well, yeah, it has something to do with the kids. Frank replies, what? And Mike looks at him. He's like, he's a fucking idiot.
Right. It's like,
he's
where
like,
you been,
you know,
man?
The disturbed kids in the work shed, the ones your wife is taking care of. Luckily, Frank has no slouch, so he's immediately puts two and two together. And he like shoves Mike into his apartment, puts on his coat, and then speeds over the Institute.
Yeah.
Because now it's like, okay, they're disturbed kids in the work shed. I saw that kid who killed Barton, who was not a child.
No,
I can only
nor assume, a human.
I can only assume everything's happening at the Institute. I should just go there right
now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just get there and, you know, just see what plays out.
And he parks on the road and then grabs a flashlight and comes in through the back, through the woods, so Dr. Ragland won't notice him. And he finds the, I was calling it a barn, but I guess it is. It's a barn. It's two stories. They call it a work shed, but it's bigger than that, you know? But Dr. Ragland finds him sort of casing out the work shed, and Frank confronts him, but Ragland tries to act like he's crazy. And until finally, Frank says they killed Ruth Mayer. And Dr. Ragland reacts to that like, oh my God. Well, if they killed Ruth Mayer, then I got to tell you everything. Like, she was the third murder.
Yeah.
And he even says, like, I didn't want to believe it. He says, I didn't want to believe it, but now she's killed Ruth Mayer. What about the other two people?
Right.
Like, what are you talking about?
They mean something.
Yeah, but it was just, it's such a funny, like, well, you got me.
In that case.
And he says, if they have her, Candace will be in the attic with them, but they will kill you if you go in there and try to take her. And Frank's like, they're just a bunch of
kids
with a lot of problems. Why would they kill me? Why would they, like, I bet Nola's loved being surrogate mother to a bunch of disturbed children. And Ragland tells him, oh, no.
She's not their surrogate mother, Frank. She's their real mother.
I'm not going to listen.
They're her children, Frank. More exactly, they're the children of her rage.
And again, he's like, and I didn't want to believe it, but now she's killed Rose Bear. It's like, okay, I guess if that's the thing that broke the camel's back. And he tells Frank, I will admit it, the bruises on Candace's back, they're from the children. And basically what happens is, and we could probably intuit this by this point in the film, when Nola becomes enraged, the brood becomes activated. So they become enraged. Yes. So she was annoyed with Candace and the brood beat Candace. She was extremely enraged at her mother. One of the brood went and tenderized her into the next life. And Frank's like, okay, well, I'm going to go get my kids. So how about you fucking help me figure out how to do this, you piece of shit? He says, okay, we have to keep the brood calm, which means we have to keep Nola calm. Because if she becomes agitated, the brood will become agitated and kill you and Candace. So I want you, Frank, to go in and apologize to your wife and ask for her to come back to you. To keep her calm. I know. And then Ragland says, I'll go in and grab Candace. Because if Nola's angry, the brood is angry. And Frank says, I don't think I trust you, Ragland. But Ragland says, does it matter? And that's a very fair point. This is win situation.
Right. Like okay. Either way, there's several people dead and some very disturbed children running around with murder in their brains.
We lost Ruth Mayer, one of our town's finest educators.
Yes.
We didn't give a fuck about these other slobs. But to have Ruth Mayer killed by the brood, unacceptable. And Frank goes to the main floor as Dr. Ragland takes this like an external wooden staircase to the attic. And he sees the brood is all asleep in their bunk beds, which is still kind of cute.
I like that they have bunk beds.
Camp. And they all have little they have brightly colored snowsuits, and then they have brightly colored like matching sweatsuits, which is
cute. Do they make noises?
Not really.
Okay.
They make
because I know
little,
they can't like talk or whatever, but is there like a like kind of going on or something?
No, and that's an interesting conversation I bet they had. I think because at this point it would be so noisy and they'd be so doodly doodly that I think making, I mean like
silent.
When the one was fighting Frank, it made some sort of fighting noises.
Mm-hmm,
but
yes,
in terms of chattering or talking, they're not doing that. They're silent. Yeah. But the brood is all asleep and they're all approximately the size of Candace. So he's going through trying to figure out which one's Candace without waking up any of the brood, which is a funny visual proposition. Frank goes in. We see Nola. She's wearing this really fabulous turtleneck white robe and is sitting legs, folded on a dais, sort of just seated like a queen.
Yes.
And he starts laying it on thick. He's like, you're the only woman in the world for me. But she tells him isolation is part of my therapy. What's happening to me is too strange for anyone in my old life to understand. So Frank says, so make me part of your new life. And she says, I don't know if you can handle it. I'm in the middle of a strange adventure, which Listen, as a woman hurtling towards middle age, that's how I feel about myself.
Same.
And he says, then let me go with you. I want to go. And she says, you do? Then look! And she throws open her robe and her body is covered in tumors, the largest of which is growing a full-sized fetus in an external amniotic sac.
Yes.
So it's sort of a translucent sack, bag with a visible fetus. Rolling around in there.
Okay. So they're not born, but they are kind of generated by her.
That's what I said. I was like, wouldn't it have an umbilical cord? It's still in her. I mean, it's like, it's attached to her body. It's feeding her in some way. But I guess then they have sacks. A lot of sacks in this
movie.
You
don't need to point out the science that doesn't work here.
And that's David Cronenberg. He's giving us exactly the information we need.
Yes.
We don't need. And then Allison, well, it's time for that baby to be born. We see Nola bend down and bite open the amniotic sac, spilling blood and fluid all over her lap, and pulls out a brand new brood baby, Allison. And because, well, we're already here, we might as well. She starts licking the blood off the baby like a dog would to clean.
No. No.
So she's just lapping the blood up.
Absolutely not.
Now, Frank's been doing a good job of acting this whole time, but he has a reasonable disgust reaction.
Good.
And Nola sees this and is like, yeah, you hate me. I repulse you.
This is repulsive.
Yeah. It's like, well, I mean, yes. Like, you aren't here because you love me. You're here because you want to take my daughter from me. It's like, well, at this point, yes, I do want that.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Before I did it. Yes. And now, yes, that is what's going to happen. Allison upstairs, Dr. Ragland finds Candace in one of the bunk beds and wakes her up. But unfortunately, he awakens the brood, and the brood is then agitated because Nola is becoming enraged, right?
Right.
Allison, they descend on Ragland, who has a gun, and fully shoots at least two of the brood, just blows these kids away.
Yeah.
But there's simply too many, and they're able to get him. They're swarmed. You know, they swarm him.
They're in a barn of bunk beds. I mean,
it's one man against a brood, and they tear him limb from limb, Allison.
Good.
Downstairs, we hear Nola screaming, I'd kill Candace before I let you take her from me. And again, the idea of a child as belonging to a parent or part of a parent rather than she's her own person, that's horrific. You know?
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, Candace, she's a smart cookie. She's able to get into a closet and lock it. But then the brood's literally just fucking punching through the door. They're soaked in Dr. Ragland's blood.
Yeah.
They're pummeling. She's screaming, panicked. And he starts shaking. Frank's downstairs starts shaking. Nolan says, you stop them. They're doing what you want. You have to calm them down. And Nola smiles. And Frank realizes, oh, my God, you want them to kill her. You want them to kill her to punish me, basically.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Allison, he wraps his hands around his throat and screams, you make them stop or I'll kill you. And she screams, kill me! Kill me then! And basically it is a race between him strangling his wife.
Yes.
And in the attic, Candace screaming as the brood grabs her through the door and is dragging her through the hole they've busted in the door.
Okay.
And finally, Frank kills Nola and she falls to the ground. And the screaming in the attic falls silent. And he runs upstairs and the entire brood is dead on the ground. But Candace is alive. Horrifically traumatized for the rest of her life.
I mean, how do you move on?
And he scoops her up and runs through the woods back to his car. And they drive away into the sunrise. And he tells his daughter, we're going home. But as they do, we see that Candace's sleeve is torn. And on her arm are bumps that appear that are rising on her skin. And the bumps are trauma. The brood.
The brood. Wow.
Yeah. So I've been doing this little segment where I connect this to the news. I'm trying to think of a title for this.
I'll work on it.
Something like Life is a Horror or Life as Horror. And the thing I want to talk about, again, these are heavy fucking duty topics, right?
Yes.
And I understand that we're not going to do this every episode. I just, again, feel remiss. All of us have to be as politically engaged as possible. And watching this, the thing that kept coming to mind, and I kind of, we don't normally do a content warnings, but I just want to make a content warning if you're a trans person.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this I know exactly this is what you're going to talk about. Yeah.
This is something that, like, it is so horrible, but it's horrific. It's on us as cis people to talk about that. I don't think if you're trans, I don't think you have to listen to this. I'm just flagging this as, like, it's been a bad year in news for trans people. So I just want to, if you are, I just want to flag that. But yeah, the thing I'm going to talk about, which if you're online at all, you probably saw, is that basically there's a representative in Montana, Zoe Zephyr, who has been censored by the Montana's legislation. So she cannot speak. During this whole ongoing democracy in crisis moment where Republicans are basically forcing a trans legislator into silence about anti-trans bills. And also there's all this, I mean, like, they're like the Montana governor, his son is non-binary and is like basically asking their father to reject these bills. Like, it sucks. And so the example I wanted to use is that basically there was one of the representatives, and I want to look up her name because she's a piece of shit.
Yeah, drag the fuck out of her.
State Representative Carrie Seekins Crow. She is a Republican, represents Billings. So her, I'm going to say daughter, because her daughter has not transitioned, but this elected official gets up and makes a comment publicly, basically saying she would have rather her daughter die by suicide than transition.
Yes.
This is, I think both, I mean, we could all agree, horrific.
Yeah, it's one of the worst things I've ever heard.
It is to use your child's pain as a political talking point, and then to not understand that you are the villain.
Yes.
You are the problem. And also to offer a window into the dysfunction of your home that you would say something. So if you're saying it to us, the nation, you have said this to your child.
To your child.
And both explicitly as you have now, and I'm sure in 1,000 different ways, that you would then be so emboldened to talk about something like this and talk about your child like you should own them and their psychic pain is meaningless to you.
As that long you control as they, their body and you control their identity just because they're your child and not because they're an individual of their own.
And this is literally a quote, you know, she made these quotes in March talking. I mean, there's a million anti-trans bills in Montana, but everywhere else, obviously. And this representative said, someone once asked me, wouldn't I just do anything to help save her? And I really had to think. And the answer was no. And I think that there's nothing else to say about Republicans on this issue. Fuck that.
Fuck that.
Fuck them. Awful. And I think this to me, that's why I wanted to talk about this movie is like, there is this idea of like the child as something to control, something to not to cultivate or to help or support, but as something that if a child extends beyond your control or becomes something that you cannot approve of, it is on you as a parent to crush that. And I think, you know, like something like Juliana denying her abuse of her daughter and be like, she's just making it up. Can you believe these kids? They're making it up. It's like that level of denial about what a horrible parent you are. This Republican is a horrible parent.
Yes.
Like this.
Objectively
a terrible parent, and also has made comments about her daughter still struggling years later. Right. So it's not, again, like the idea of like, oh, this is a phase. They don't really believe that. They don't actually give a fuck about teenagers.
No. They just think that that's a time that you should still absolutely be in control of your own child as a parent and be making all of the decisions regardless of what your child is asking for, which will save their life.
And there is, I just want to bring that up because there is a deep, there's a deep pathology in the Republican Party that we all can see. And a lot of it has to do with this idea that, like, you know, the woke mind virus, which basically means anything progressive, anything on the left, anything that's genuinely invested in making the world a better place, they think of as a contaminant. And there was even some article where it was like, where do these woke ideas come from? It's like, from abolition? Like, I don't know. It's like,
yeah.
Where, from Jesus Christ? Like, from every religion? Like, these yeah. are the quote woke ideas. Yeah. And I think, I don't know, there's something about it that to me really spoke to how far gone the Republican Party is, that you would say that publicly about your own child and think that we're supposed to hear that and be like, you're
and
right.
And be like, correct.
Good. I'm glad that your child is fucking miserable and continues to be, because you couldn't handle it for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah.
Anywho, children are their own people. You should allow them.
Yes.
Support them. And also, like, they do, like, as a mother, for some reason, I think in a culture, like, we think, like, as if you're a mother, your choices are correct. We have to move past that, too. We have too many mothers in government, in this case, a white cis mother who fundamentally is still beholden to these systems that control us, too. Like, you know, like that hurt every woman, hurt every person. But for some reason, like, well, I'm a mother, so my ideas about the world should be for my child.
Supersede, like, any safety and, you know, concerns that you would have. Yeah.
So, anyways, I just wanted to bring that up. Back to the movie. Allison, what are some fatal mistakes you think that someone may have made in the movie The Brood?
Fatal mistakes.
I mean, going to an institute like this to start with feels like, not that you shouldn't seek psychiatric help for things that you need help with, but boy, this wasn't the one. This is not.
Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, I guess we used to see it all the time, is like, we are, I don't know whether it's a particularly American thing or just everywhere in the world. It's like, man, if someone says they finally have the solution, we want to believe they do.
Yeah, we do, but they usually don't.
They almost certainly do not, especially when they have some sort of new institute where they pretend to be your daddy and berate you in front of a crowd of strangers.
No, that's not medicine.
That's not medicine. That could be a good time, depending on what you're interested in.
Yeah,
but, like,
but it's not medicine.
Yeah, it's
not trauma treatment.
And I think Juliana and Barton, bad parents, you know, like...
Yeah.
And that's why I do think that, like, I understand how this movie might seem misogynistic, but I think we're supposed to, like, Nola's rage is valid. It's that, like, that rage is perverted into to horrific ends by a doctor who basically was facilitating this up until he heard about Ruth Mayer dying. He wanted this to happen. This was proof that he was correct. Yes. So he was willing to sacrifice anything. Her rage is valid, but instead of dealing with it, again, like all her movies, it's about trauma.
It's about trauma.
Trauma. Not dealing with your trauma. The ultimate fatal mistake.
The ultimate
in every
fatal
fucking
mistake
movie.
Across the board in every film.
And in every life. So, and then where would you like to put the movie on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
This one feels like a 4.
Ooh, okay.
To me. Like, I think, like, the little critters, like, a scary thing, but, like, very much not real. But I do think, like, the concept of, like, an institute where, like, someone is being kept from someone else and you don't know what's going on there is very scary.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm going to give it a 5.
Oh, wow.
Just because you know that David Cronenberg gets me every time. Mm-hmm. When you see the... lymphosarcoma on his neck. I had like a visceral disgust reaction. But yeah, this is not a particularly scary one. And I do think having little demented children as the villain does lower the scariness of it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so it was more interesting and entertaining than actually scary. But then there were moments where
absolutely.
You know, when you see that little hand grab that little paperweight. Like anything with kids where you realize that those two kids are in fact creatures. Yeah, but 5 seems good. I feel like that it's a fiver for sure. Well, everyone, thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying Mommy Issues Month. Please let us know about what your issues with your mother are, and just
more
in general,
mommies to come.
More mommies to come. All right. Well, until next time, everybody.
Please
keep it spooky. We love you.
We love you. Don't forget to follow us at Ruin Podcast and Crooked Media for show updates. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Ruined is a Radio Point and Crooked Media production. We're your writers and hosts, Hallie Kiefer and Allison Leiby. The show is executive produced by Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder, and recorded and edited by Kat Iosa. From Crooked Media, our executive producer is Kendra James, with production and promotional support from Ari Schwartz, Kyle Sieglin, Julia Beach, Caroline Dunphy, and Awa Okolade.